and present for the record, we do have a quorum. It includes Senator French, Stevens, Green, Bundy, and myself, McGuire. We have three items on the agenda today. The first will be Senate Bill number 45, Peace Officer Convicted of Murder by Senator Olson. Then we have Senate Bill number 25, State Planning and Budget by Senator Dyson. I guess we're going to have a PowerPoint for that. And then we'll bring back up Senate Bill 36, Sentencing for Alcohol-Related Crimes. And so without further ado, let's hear about Senate Bill number 45.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm sorry that Senator Olson isn't here to present this bill. It's an issue that's near and dear to the district he represents, and I prefer his testimony than my own, that way. In a sponsor statement, this bill mandates the maximum sentence for a peace officer who's convicted of first-degree murder. It stems from a case that happened in Nome where a young woman was murdered, and she was well-liked, well-known throughout the region, and it caused an awful lot of consternation and just upset in the region. There was a long investigation. Finally, there was an indictment and a conviction. It really kind of tore up the region on what happened and how it happened. Indeed, the trial itself was moved to Kotzebue. In the sentencing of the convicted murderer, the state's prosecutor noted that that the maximum mandatory sentence is we placed in law for anybody murdering a peace officer, and that this case itself was kind of the complement. Peace officer who's entrusted with civil protection and law and order of our constituents, you know, should be held to a higher standard for extreme misconduct of this nature. The prosecutor and the judge sentenced the individual to the maximum extent. Since then, the region has almost unanimously come forward to request this legislation that the maximum be placed in law. And that's what this bill does. You'll hear testimony today from several people in the region to discuss further how important they feel this legislation is. With that, I'll leave you with any questions and further testimony.
Questions? Senator Bundy.
Thank you. In this case, the fellow was sentenced to 99 years. The bill would require a 99-year sentence. So what the bill does is just guarantee a 99, takes away judicial discretion, and so wouldn't have changed the outcome of this trial and this sentencing at all.
That's correct. This bill will have no effect on what occurred in Nome to Sonia Ivanov. Mm-hmm. But again,
anybody in the room?
It was requested by many people in Nome that in the region to make certain that anybody, peace officer, convicted of first-degree murder, faced the maximum.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions from the committee, for the bill sponsors, representative? Okay, did you have, was Department of Law here to testify as well?
Madam Chairman, I'm here, but I wasn't intending to testify.
Okay.
Actually, I know quite a bit about that case, so if anyone has any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Okay, are there any questions for the Department of Law? Okay, Lauren, did you? Want to testify? Oh, Commissioner should be online. Okay, so let me go to the folks online then. Yes, we do. We have Walt Monaghan. Commissioner Monaghan is on the telephone. Commissioner Monaghan, good morning.
Good morning. I was getting the word unmuted at the same time you were talking, so I suspect it's my turn.
Yes, it is.
Well, good morning. This is Walt Monaghan, Commissioner of Department of Public Safety, and I want to say thank you for allowing me to testify on this issue. My concern is not so for any of the punishment that a police officer or anyone in public trust who violates the law, but rather the way that that it's currently worded, it may have some unintended consequences that must be considered, I think. One of them is that probably on the outset, if in the complicated case where there is an officer who shoots a suspect and there are other individuals who are taken into custody, I would hate to see that whatever the issue originally started, the officer to make that approach with to begin with, gets complicated by a second or muddying the water by a defense or a civil action based on the way the present law is worded. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of something for legal and law to kind of work through, I believe. And but perhaps more fundamentally, as a police officer, there, even though in our training and our use of deadly force and our policies and everything else, it isn't necessarily our intent to, when we use deadly force, to shoot to kill anybody. Our training requires that we shoot center mass, meaning that the biggest portion of the person, because that is where we are going to probably stop the fight more readily than anywhere else, and we have a greater chance of hitting versus unlike movies where you see cowboys shoot guns out of bad guys' hands, that doesn't happen. What happens, I think, that in many cases, and having been there very close on a personal case, is that often the trooper or the officer is confronted with imperfect information and has to make a split second decision. And then later, it is reviewed largely by everybody who now has the complete set of facts and can watch it from the safety and in the full daylight of all the facts as they come to be. So the way we train or way we investigate on force reviews is that we try to gear it to what the officer or trooper would have known at the time, so we can understand the mindset and whether the policy was utilized correctly or was it violated. And again, I think this goes back to my first thing, that in many cases, once the other defendants are brought to trial, I could see it being complicated by some defense attorneys and making issue of specifically citing that 1141-100, murder in the first degree, a person commits the crime of murder if with the intent to cause death of another person. If somebody pulls a weapon on you and you are trained to respond and you shoot center mass, there is a high likelihood that you actually could kill somebody. And in fact, some of the failure drills, because of what you may have seen in other locations, our officers and troopers are trained that if you deploy or dispense two rounds into center mass or the chest area of a armed suspect and that person's still standing, then we have to go to what we call failure drills, which means you shoot either for the head or for the hips to knock that person down if they're still standing, because perhaps that person's wearing a ballistic vest. And again, that could be certainly on the surface viewed as with the intent to cause death. And especially if the issue is, if it's the defendant is a peace officer who was on the duty at the time of the murder. Now, I understand the spirit of the bill and how it has to be. And again, I have no problem with anyone, no matter whom it is, to face the consequences of criminal acts. But I would sure hate to see that this cause hesitation within the troopers and with the officers when they're out in the field and suddenly they're confronted. If I can kind of give you one quick personal scenario that happened to me several years back, and a number of years back. I was sent to look for an individual who was reportedly, through secondhand information, waiting to shoot his girlfriend. It was information was pretty sketchy. He was described as a black male adult sitting in a Mazda, and I was given the address of where the girlfriend was, which happened to be downtown Anchorage on a summer afternoon. Well, I drove down there just for a look, and I found one Mazda parked in on the street, and there was one black man sitting in it. So I went around the corner, I logged off on a possible, and I walked up and I approached the individual. He was on the passenger side of the car, window open because it was summertime, and he's looking at the address where the girl was. He didn't see me come up from behind him. So when I identified myself, I asked for some identification. I was given a name. He produced an ID card. The information I was told was this individual was a mental person in that he had just been attempted suicide and had been released out of the hospital. He was a convicted armed robber, and that there was a warrant for his arrest for sexual assault. The name that he gave me on the ID card was the same name, but different first name, same last name, different first name. And then my portable, which was on my hip, I corrected it and gave me the correct name, of which he heard his name on the radio. And what he did was, it happened very fast. His right arm was resting on the open window of the door, and he reached in slowly into his shirt, and then he started to pull out very quickly, a handgun that was tucked inside of his shirt in the waistband. I saw the grips, the cylinder, the hammer, everything was sliding out, recognized it to be a revolver. And my own training, muscle memory, I already had my weapon being pulled out of my own holster. But in the time that it takes you to, in essence, slap your hip and bring your hand up like you were drawing a weapon, I reviewed a California case, Schmerber versus California. I went through four different thresholds of decision-making processes and decided that, and made my decision that if that barrel swings around towards my direction, I will pull the trigger. I don't think I'm unusual. I don't think that, I think this is a very standard issue as far as police is concerned and police training. But the thing that throwed me for a loop at the very end was the hesitation that could I shave in the morning? Could I look if I kill someone? Well, it all turned out I took the man into custody. He froze. I didn't have to hurt him, it was an okay thing. But what I'm saying is that if this law was in there, as worded, then I think that would throw yet one more decision-making process for a trooper or an officer on a lonely road in the middle of the night. And I would hate to see them hesitate, because when hesitation occurs, somebody does get hurt. And I guess what I'd be asking is maybe the committee could look at this, not in the defining words as it is now, but perhaps in as an aggravator in the bill, so that when comes sentencing time, that if the individual who commits the crime is a police officer, trooper, or another person of public trust, that that would be added as an aggravator versus clearly lining it out as it is now.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, Commissioner. That's a good point, and, you know, state law requires now, after the federal case, that a trial for an aggravator be a separate trial, but it may be warranted. What is the bill's sponsor's staff?
Madam Chairman, the senator does not want to interfere with the situations that may come up to a police officer and inhibit what they have to face. This is a whole different situation that he's trying to address, where a peace officer is not acting in the best standards for public protection, but is a predator situation.
Okay, Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make a couple observations. It's a very interesting bill, very touchy bill, and it's got a serious case behind it. A couple of thoughts. One, right now, a police officer convicted of murder in the first degree faces a sentence of 20 to 99. That's on the books. That's not going to change with or without this bill.
Yep.
So every police officer facing every conflict, if you will, with a suspect has in the back of his mind, I could get convicted of murder in the first degree, and I'm going to face a sentence of 20 to 99. So that calculus just gets more serious with the bill. It doesn't introduce, if you will, a new calculus. It just increases the severity of it. The aggravator idea, I think we probably should hear from the Department of Law, but I don't think that aggravators properly apply to unclassified felonies. I don't think that it matters if you have an aggravator. The sentence for murder in the first degree is 20 to 99 with or without any aggravators. And it's there's other factors that go into the judge's decision, but I don't think that's a viable out, if you will, for the committee to go that direction. So that's just two thoughts more than questions. I guess I do have one question, either for the sponsor or for someone testifying or for the Department of Law, and that's with the definition where the bill asks, or the bill declares, that the defendant is a peace officer on duty at the time of the murder. And I was just looking back on page 1, lines 10, where we're talking about peace officers, firefighters, and so forth, and there the definition is engaged in the performance of official duties. Is there a difference? Is there not a difference? Was there a conscious decision to pick the, sounds like a fairly more relaxed term, on duty versus engaged in the performance of official duties? And it just may be worth some comment from one of the witnesses before too far along. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I think that the drafter drafted to the language suggested by an AFN resolution on this issue, so I doubt that that thought went into the drafting of the bill language, and is certainly something that's open for your consideration for adjustment.
Okay, thank you very much. We do have one woman on the line with a time constraint. Oh, Senator Bundy?
Go ahead.
If I could just take hers briefly. She's in Nome, and she has a time constraint, I'm told. So I'd like to take her testimony briefly, and then we'll get back to the analysis of the bill. Loretta Bullard in Nome. Are you there, Loretta?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Please go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you very much for this opportunity to testify. My name is Loretta Bullard, and I'm president of CLORC, which is the regional nonprofit corporation. I am testifying in support of this bill. As a long-term resident of Nome, I wanted to speak to the horror that the entire community of Nome experienced when Sonia Ivanov was killed. No one knew who had killed this beautiful, vibrant, promising young woman. Her family, friends, and the community and the region at large were devastated. There were a number of individuals who were suspected early on, wrongly, as it turns out. When a member of the Nome Police Department came under suspicion, there was a point of time where the Nome Police Department was basically trying to investigate one of their own. I'm thankful that the Alaska State Troopers were called in and were able to get the information together that resulted in a conviction in this case. When it came to the sentencing, I think, I'm not sure who it was that spoke earlier to the fact that a police officer convicted of first-degree murder is currently exposed to a 20 to 99-year sentence. During the sentencing portion of the trial, there were family and friends of the defendant who were advocating for a minimum sentence. And I think the entire region was pretty horrified to realize that conceivably he could be sentenced to a short time frame, he could get time off for good behavior, he could be eligible for parole, and that's the reason that we are recommending that this bill be adopted. We strongly believe that a police officer should be held to a stringent standard, since as an officer of the law, they've sworn to uphold it. They are individuals who we, in times of need, turn to for help. Matt Owens failed in his capacity as a sworn police officer and as a human being. The language that is before the committee would ensure that peace officers convicted of first-degree murder while on duty would receive a mandatory sentence of 99 years. Our understanding is that a separate state statute, AS 33.19.90, removes the possibility of being eligible for discretionary parole for crimes listed in Alaska Statutes 1255-125. However, there is no prohibition against early release for good behavior, which would result in a reduction to time served by one-third. We recommend that the language be amended to remove any possibility of early release and that the amended legislation be forwarded for consideration by the Senate Judiciary Committee. As part of my testimony, I've forwarded, and I think Dave Gray will give those to you, copies of resolutions from CLERC as well as the North Sound Health Corporation Board of Directors in support of this bill. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Loretta, are there questions? Okay. Yes, Senator Bundy.
I have a question back to Commissioner Monaghan.
Okay. So, Loretta, you're free to go. Thank you. So, Commissioner Monaghan, are you still on the line? Senator Bundy has a question directed to you.
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Yeah, good morning, Commissioner. Help me understand if a sworn officer who's off duty as out of uniform, whatever, witnesses a crime, does his oath require him to then take some official action or act as a police officer even though he's not wearing a uniform?
That's correct. It's called under the color of authority. There are times that it isn't, it could be excused not to be, but the expectation by the department and by the community is that some action should be taken.
So basically an officer is never off duty, and the distinction that's trying to be drawn here, and I'm not sure what the verbiage would be, can you see something between, and as Senator French said, in performance of your official duties versus just the fact that you're a police officer, and so you're basically a police officer 24/7.
Well, I certainly agree with the what the intent of what this is. I mean, because police officers are symbols. I mean, they are the highest standards, and many. In fact, all departments should be very conscious and on the screening criteria to hire the best possible that they can find. But now and then, no matter how good you are, something will go awry, and those who decide to step outside of the law and violate it, especially in positions of trust like police officers, should and must be held accountable. But it isn't the idea for the there's two different issues. One, of course, is using your job to be a predator, and that is totally criminal. And the other one is where this could be interpreted and cause hesitation and or confusion in the downstream or in the act itself by any officer who is responding to the training that they have already been given. So it's a very subtle difference, maybe from most people on the outside, but clearly there's not a criminal intent for an officer or a trooper to respond with deadly force when confronted with it to defend themselves or defend somebody else. And the way this is worded, it can easily be interpreted to be that way. So, and that was why it would be better, I think, even though Senator French said that aggravators may not apply, that if this was worded in an aggravator sense, it could be one of those things to go along that maybe the 20-year thing is not appropriate, maybe 99 is, for an officer who criminally intends to bring harm to somebody else. And as opposed to respond to training within policy, within law, for justified homicide.
Senator Bundy, follow up?
Yeah, thank you. this is, of course, a very egregious case. Are you aware of other cases where a police officer, while in a line of duty, having to unfortunately kill someone, where they've been charged with murder?
In my history here in Anchorage, I cannot think of it. However, what I'm anticipating would be more so the civil actions afterwards. And I kind of run a parallel to what happened over to our former football hero down in California.
O.J.?
Yeah, O.J., where he was not convicted but he was on a civil case. They used the power of the law to allow that to be an unlawful death kind of thing. And we have been sued, or the Anchorage Police Department had been sued for shooting somebody or taking the life of somebody, and this has happened in the past. I think that what this has the potential of, the way it's strictly black and white written as is, that it could be utilized as a part of a smoke and mirrors technique to confuse the issue on other defendants that were taken into custody if one of them had been killed. And it does certainly open up, I think, a little bit more on the civil side as well. But again, that is my intuitive feelings. That is something for law to figure out. My biggest concern is that hesitation point. And the police officers have a tough job at in any given time. And especially in situations where they have to make a choice whether to use or not to use deadly force. I would hate to think that in the back of their minds, knowing that the way this bill is worded, that they are literally could be in violation of the law. It could be interpreted as such.
Thank you, Commissioner Monaghan. And we have the Department of Law here. And I just wanted to ask, number one, Senator Bundy asked one question I was going to ask, which was, could you recall a case where a police officer was in a circumstance such as described by Commissioner Monaghan and charged with murder? And the answer was no. I wanted to hear your take on that, if you had a different recollection. That's number one. And number two, it seems to me that even if those circumstances arose, that it wouldn't be first-degree murder. That the situation that Chief Monaghan described would certainly not be an intentional causing of death, that it could be a second-degree murder. It might even be a manslaughter, that certainly they're taught to aim for the trunk. And you heard the commissioner state that in their police training that they're not taught to aim for the temple or the head in certain death, that they're taught to sort of stop the suspect from moving forward or disable them from shooting back. So to me, that doesn't rise to the level of first-degree murder anyway. But I just wanted to hear your take on that.
Madam Chairman, I'm Rick Sabodnia. I'm the Chief Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the State of Alaska. And actually, I'm the person who prosecuted Matt Owens, the person you're talking about. Matt Owens is the only police officer I know of in the state of Alaska who has been charged with murder, either in the first or second degree. I think it was, and hopefully will be, continue to be a unique case in this state. So to answer Senator Bundy's question, I don't believe there has been any other case. To answer the chair's question, it's difficult in the abstract to answer your question. The state always would have to prove that a police officer acted with the intent to kill. And in the situation dealing with a police officer responding to a situation, you're more often going to be looking at the defenses to a crime, whether that's self-defense, whether there was a justification for doing what he or she did. It is highly unlikely that a police officer would ever be charged with murder
in the first or second degree if they're responding to a situation. It's conceivable that a police officer was acting with such wanton disregard and somebody ended up shot. For example, if you had a police officer chasing somebody for shoplifting in a mall of hundreds of people and they just started emptying their gun in the direction of the fleeing shoplifter, you might, and somebody got killed, you may well be looking at a manslaughter where they've acted recklessly.
Okay, those are all my questions. Any questions from the committee?
I just had one.
Yes, Senator Green.
And I was wondering of the inclusion of the on duty. I mean, would we not expect a like behavior if they're, quote, off duty? And if someone could make the case that they were off duty, would it then be okay and not subject to the 99-year?
Do you have any thoughts on that from the Department of Law?
Actually, the sponsor and I talked briefly about the language on duty, and I think what happened in Nome was was the officer used his authority to get a young, a 19-year-old girl into his patrol car, and he did it with several other people before, but this girl fought back, not this girl, Sonia. And she ended up dead because he used his authority to get her in a situation where he could ultimately kill her. The way that it's drafted right now, a police officer who, say, was on duty and his wife came into the police department, they had an argument, and he ultimately killed her. He intended to do it. He would be captured under this provision, and it just happened to be that he was a police officer on duty, not using his authority as a police officer. And I think that the language about just being on duty needs to be tightened up a little bit.
Do you have any suggestions for that? I don't disagree. I think I think Senator Green's getting at that point too, that you could be off duty, but using the color of your authority to get young women or other circumstances to try and use that power, and it would be equally offensive even if you weren't on duty at the time. And then you pose the other scenario where you're off duty technically or on duty technically, but you weren't using that color of authority to enter into the crime. Do you have better language?
Can I?
Madam Chairman, you may have just used the better language, use of the color of his authority, under the color of his authority, or something like that, and we would certainly gladly work with the committee and the sponsor on that language.
Okay, and Senator French and then Senator Stevens.
Just a couple questions. I have an off case, Mr. Zivobondi. Were you able to prove that this took place while Mr. Owen was on duty? Was that part of your case?
Yes, it was. Nome is not a very large community, and after midnight, there are only two police officers on duty. Sonia Ivanov got into a patrol car driven by one of those two police officers, and we were able to prove that it was on duty in the course of his duties.
Thank you.
Senator Stevens.
Is Commissioner Monaghan still on?
I am.
What I'm asking, I guess, I don't want to take us far away from the issue at hand, but and it's a terrible case, a terrible incident, and as we've heard, the only incident of its type, I guess, that's occurred, according to the department. But how did it happen that somebody who is a predator? I mean, there must. I assume the police practices have many ways to weed predators out. So isn't that sort of a big issue as well? What in the police departments would cause them, allow them to be able to weed out predators before an incident like this would occur?
Well, actually, it depends on the department and how strict they are in following their own guidelines in background checks and other screening criteria. But as an industry or a profession, we certainly try to do the best possible job. But again, there are some things that, especially in the areas of sex, sex issues, those are probably the most buried, if you will, within the individual that they're usually not willing to disclose, especially if they're something that would be I guess, categorized as deviant. And so it takes a real persistent and thorough background to try to root out those kind of histories or trends so that they could be eliminated.
Well, I appreciate that, Commissioner, and I can understand the problems that you must have in trying to weed out predators. But in this case, it sounds like there were several incidents ahead of the murder in which young girls were taken into the police car. So, I mean, someone must have known of that. It seems to me that somehow, I mean, I appreciate where we are now, but maybe another issue is to look at how can we do a better job to make sure that people like this are not in uniform.
Well, I agree, and I think that I would probably bet you dollars to donuts right now, right after this event. I'm sure Nome probably pored over what their screening criteria was, and as well as every other police department in this state, just to look for and how good are we testing on it. I can tell you that when I was with APD, when we had the first case of where an officer was found to have pornography on his work computer, well, we dived into that, and there wasn't anything that we in the background that would have disclosed it. And so in some cases, I was told, people just have a tendency to evolve into a different person from when they were hired. And those latent tendencies would come out. But I don't have the answer in this particular case with Nome because I was not a part of that. But if I have a question for the committee to consider, if I may.
Go ahead.
On this proposed bill, on page 2, I guess, line 9, the addition that says the defendant is a peace officer, could the wording be the defendant is a peace officer who acted with criminal intent and under color of authority at the time of the murder?
Yeah, it's not bad.
That way, I think that in our continued training, that it separates what we're trying to do, mm-hmm. And I think any officer should be able to readily identify that this is what I am responding to, and it'll be every deadly incident will be investigated. There's no doubt it has to be, but the idea that with criminal intent, that separates that from you acting on behalf of yourself or someone else in this deploying of deadly force.
Thank you, Commissioner Monaghan. Department of Law, do you have a reaction
to that particular type of language? I guess as prosecutors, when we get to culpable mental states, this is a sentencing provision. And the culpable mental states really in the charging provision, that is, you intended to kill the person. And I think under the color of authority, or acted under the color of his authority type of language, it sounds like it's good language. I don't know of any sentencing provision that builds, well, maybe there are some aggravating factors that builds into a sentencing provision, a particular state of mind. I have some concerns about that, and I'd certainly talk to the commissioner about it, but I think we can work out language that covers what everyone wants.
Yeah, and I agree it would be kind of duplicitous in the way that, I mean, if you've already met the mental intent. But I understand, Commissioner Monaghan, your point, which is more of a public relations issue, that you don't want, and I heard you say this many times, you don't want an officer to have one more thing to think about, to hesitate. And so I think no matter, you know, how we do the language, I think we need to make it clear to you and to the folks that get trained, you know, what we mean, that it's that clearly that abuse of your color of authority, and that we don't mean for men and women in the line of duty to have to, you know, to sit back and think whether or not they ought to be acting in good faith as a police officer. So,
well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. And Senator Stevens, and then we have one more person online.
Well, just to follow up on that, I'm not sure that a police officer would ever not be acting under the color of authority. I mean, you would always be people would always be aware he what this person was a police officer, whether he's in uniform or not. And so it's, I don't see when that would occur that you'd be not under the color of authority. I'm not familiar with that definition, but maybe you can explain it a little further.
I think through the chair, the example that I gave, a police officer was clearly on duty in uniform at the police station,
yeah.
And somebody there's problems at home, and they come and the spouse comes in, and they have an argument, and one ends up killing. Turns out that the officer ends up killing his or her spouse. I mean, it's not as a result of being a using the authority of his position to have committed that crime.
I'm just thinking of the case in Nome. I mean, this officer was always under the color of authority, I would assume.
Well, when he committed the crimes, he certainly was, yes.
Small town, everyone knew he was the police officer.
That's right.
Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Monaghan, I was penciling, just jotting some thoughts down as you were speaking, and I'm wondering whether something along the lines of this formulation might ease the concern of your troopers and the other peace officers in the state. If we reworded this to say that the defendant is a peace officer who acts contrary to established police practices and under color of the authority of his or her position to commit the murder, whether that wouldn't somehow alleviate your concerns about having to filter one more piece of information in the course of your dangerous jobs.
Actually, something like that would work in to, again, not to confuse the trainers or the trainees about this issue. So something, anything like that, that clearly says the officer is acting within their scope of duties, their accepted and trained scope of duties, versus totally outside the law. And something like that would work well.
Okay. So I'm going to go ahead and take the final person's testimony. We'll set the bill aside and bring it back up next week with an amendment that will allow the sponsor to talk with the Department of Law along with members of the committee about what that right language is. But I think we're all headed in the same direction. Gail Schubert?
Yes.
If you're there. Gail, go ahead and offer your testimony, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and fellow senators. My name is Gail Schubert, and I'm the Executive Vice President and General Counsel for the Bering Straits Native Corporation. I have a somewhat personal connection to this case. My niece is married to the deceased's brother, Glenn Ivanoff. And so when this matter came before the Bering Straits Board, the board, because of the fact that Ms. Ivanoff was in her prime and was well-liked and was basically at the start of what she hoped to be a successful life starting in Nome, and was subsequently murdered by the police officer. We took the matter fairly seriously and adopted what turned out to be the first resolution in support of what we referred to as the Sonia Ivanoff law. And in adopting the resolution, the board considered a number of factors. And included in that is the fact that one of the fundamental duties of a law enforcement officer is to serve the community, safeguard lives and property, protect the public, and respect the constitutional rights of all to liberty, equality, and justice. And the board believed that because of the law enforcement position, that if a law enforcement officer commits murder, that they should be held to a higher standard. When the law enforcement officer in question committed the murder, he breached that trust. And when he did that, he set forth a tidal wave of distrust against law enforcement officers and the judicial system that reverberated throughout the Native community in Western Alaska. In the sentencing hearing, the state's prosecutor, Rick Sabovny, and I apologize if I mispronounced that name, cited the statute in question that is proposed to be amended as justification for imposing a sentence of 99 years of imprisonment for the police officer who murdered Sonia Ivanoff. He also opined during the sentencing hearing that an equivalent sentence should result if a police officer is convicted of murder in the first degree for a crime that is committed while the officer is on duty. And the presiding judge, Ben Esch, agreed with the state's attorney's rationale and thankfully imposed the maximum sentence of 99 years on the police officer in question. And we believe, and we stated this in the resolution, which I'll forward to the committee, that the legislature has an opportunity to restore confidence in the justice system for all Alaska residents, no matter where they live, and assure that justice is equally applied for all residents. One of the things that I'd like to point out regarding Senate Bill 45 is that it does provide that basically this provision does not kick in unless the police officer is convicted of murder in the first degree. And presumably that police officer would have a jury of 12 who would hear the facts and circumstances and decide whether, in fact, murder in the first degree is an appropriate conviction. And then you would have the 99-year sentence that would be imposed. And the final thing that I would ask is request that the that this proposed law or amendment be changed to be called the Sonia Ivanov law so that Ms. Ivanov's death would not have been in vain.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Gail. And I can assure you that I speak for, you know, many members, if not all, of the legislature, how awful that case was and how gut-wrenching to think that it was somebody who was, you know, using their position as a police officer to commit those crimes and that it had been going on for a long time. And I know I have read articles that people in Nome have felt like perhaps they were abandoned or these issues were not being looked at, paid attention to by the whole of the state, and I can assure you that they are. We will get some version of this bill through. The good news, I think, is that the justice system in this case did respond, and Owens was given a 99-year sentence. And so I think to the extent that we think things are broken, that part of it was right. That was the right sentence. And so this bill would just simply ensure that would be the case in every circumstance that involved a police officer using their color of authority to commit a murder. But I think we can be appreciative that the justice system worked in this case. Okay, so with that, anybody else in the audience I've overlooked? Okay, on Senate Bill number 45. Anybody else online? Okay, hearing none. Public testimony is closed. That'll bring the bill back before us. Senator Bundy.
Just reflecting on your comments and previous comments, and I'm wondering if anyone in a position of authority should be brought under the scope of this. Teachers, clergy, I'm not aware of any crime, certainly at the level of egregiousness of this one, but much like with sexual assault, if anyone who's in a position of authority, it's an aggravator or a greater degree of crime in the public's view, and I'm just asking if you thought that that ought to include other people in position of authority.
Well, let's think on that. I don't think that's a bad idea. We'll bring the bill back up Tuesday. With an eye toward the amendments, and appreciate everybody's time. Thank you, Department of Law. Okay, so Senator Dyson, without further ado, you've got a PowerPoint even, I'm told. Becoming a real city slicker. Okay. And these are to testify on, no questions. Okay. Great. Okay, Senate Bill number 25. And my apologies, Senator French and Stevens, it's behind you if you
I
could.
May reposition myself,
okay.
If that's okay.
Absolutely. Please feel free to. It was the only open wall in this room, so. Senator Dyson.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for the committee for hearing the bill as early in the session. All of us have struggled with how to do and figure out how to put together a financial plan for the state. And my colleague, Lucky Schultz, is both undergraduate and graduate degrees are in financial planning and management and has been an industry or a consultant, and in our during the interim, we were talking about what can we do, and you watched our office struggle with spending caps, constitutional spending caps, and trying to figure out how to do that. And the work you're going to see here in Senate Bill 25 is largely Lucky's work. And I learned in from the Bible and high school biology that evil and bacteria grow in the dark. And certainly dragging things out into the light is almost always a very good strategy. What this bill does then is ask that the administration do their reveal to us and our constituents a 25-year plan for where the state is going to be in its financial affairs. So because of Lucky's expertise and experience and my throat, I'm going to let Lucky largely speak to this. But thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Lord.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lucky Schultz, and I am staff to Senator Dyson. First of all, let me make clear that this bill does not make a 25-year plan. It merely asks the governor to provide a 25-year plan and let the legislature know the elements, or key elements anyway, of that plan. There seems to be, at least across Alaska and many parts of the nation, more people wanting to know what our government is doing on a long range and how we're going to get there and how we're going to take care of issues. I spent the last several years of my private life working with corporations putting together strategic plans, and many times those plans were not very successful because we didn't know what we were doing and what we were looking for into the future. So over the past couple of years working with the legislature, I've heard many Alaskans say, I wonder what our long-range plan is. And my response has to be, either we're not very good at communicating what our long-range plan is, or we don't have a long-range plan. And so with that, I've asked that this bill be considered where the governor would tell us the key elements of a long-range plan, looking into the future. What are our costs going to be? What are our revenues going to be? How are we going to balance the budget? And I'll cover part of that. This presentation this morning is primarily a why, and it's pretty quick. It won't last long. But probably best said by Mr. Lou Williams, who is a retired publisher of the Ketchikan Daily News. Essentially, he says, we need an economic plan. Alaskans have been talking about it for years. Last year, I attended a conference, and probably seven or eight members of the presenters all said, we need a plan. Nobody was willing to say what that plan should be. Obviously, it's not unique. Chris Edwards, Director of Tax Policy, talks about the Medicaid costs rising. We're all aware of what the Medicaid costs are going to be in Alaska. We know what the huge shortfalls in employee retirement benefits are going to be. Nationwide, $700 billion. So Alaska's not alone in that area. An estimate by the Mercer Human Resources, the retirement health care plans alone, $1 trillion across the country. And also, not just costs, but manpower. Human capital, talent, as some corporations call it. 500 biggest companies will lose half their senior managers in 5 years. At the civil service, it's going to be even higher. State government, federal government is going to begin wrestling pretty soon with how do we take care, how do we make sure we have the people to run government. It is essential to plan ahead, as according to the survey. What other people are doing? The European Commission has an energy efficiency action plan. They're looking ahead to 2020 and said we need to reduce energy consumption by 20%. A couple of months ago, I noticed Brazil has an 80-year plan. BP has been here a number of times talking about their 50-year plan. And we had an article in the last issue of the Journal of Commerce talking about their 50-year plan and the difficulty they're getting finding people. I talked to someone at ConocoPhillips. In Houston, Fleur Daniel is looking for 2,000 employees right away. They have a problem meeting near term. They're looking at how they're going to make the long term. And of course, Japanese companies are notorious for their 100-year plans. Most of you have probably seen this chart. Shel Fraska drafted it up last year as part of the
presentation to do with PPT in different versions. This version shows PPT of House Bill 3001, known as the now infamous gully chart, shows our unrestricted general fund revenues declining from oil. And again, this is no surprise to anyone. At the time this chart was drafted, we were looking at getting gas revenues in the 2010-2011 time frame. Obviously, that's not going to happen. We know now that a gas pipeline will take probably 10 years before we start seeing revenue from any gas pipeline. So what does that mean to us? Well, the DNR put together this chart last January. Maybe more dramatically shows a decline in production. And while prices may be high at $100 a barrel for just 10 barrels, you're not going to make your revenue. So that's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin, is Senator Green and her foresight last year asked the Lumen Group to look at Medicaid costs and what they would be for the future. What we found was if you look just a few years in the future, there's not much difference to look at. Yes, costs are going up, costs are going down. But if you look at about the 2015 time frame, all of a sudden seniors start escalating. And about 2017, 2018, they surpass spending of any other age group in Alaska. Now, part of that is for a couple of reasons. One is Alaska, like everywhere else, the population is aging. Also, for the first time in recent history, we have elderly senior people emigrating to Alaska. Rather than moving out to warmer climates, they're moving here, partly because their children are here, partly because we have better road infrastructure now, partly because of the hospitals, partly because of entertainment. But for whatever reason, we have more seniors moving here. Also, cost of Medicaid are going up. If you look at, again, the Lewin report shows what our annual growth rate will be. Compound the number of seniors here, the fact that seniors have a higher cost for Medicaid, compound the fact that Medicaid costs are going up, and you see that also the fact that the federal government is going to continue to reduce their share of Medicaid. Our share is going to go from about $350 million to over $2 billion by 2025. We need to begin looking ahead now at what this impact is going to be for the state. Another chart showing the impact of just Medicaid. It's a poor chart, but you see at the bottom health and the percentage, and this is from the FY08 budget allocation among the different departments. If we increased health by the percentage indicated by Lewin Group for 2025 and hold all other departments constant and only increase revenue to cover the increased health, health takes up almost half of our budget by 2025. But we know we're adding money for education. So if we add education in here, we squeeze other departments even more. So the question is, how are we going to balance our budget when education and health are consuming so much of the budget? But education is not the last item we have to contend with either. We have health and social issues. We have education. We have unfunded liabilities. Mm-hmm. If it's $1 trillion nationwide, and Senator Green mentioned a few weeks ago in a meeting, I heard that we're looking at perhaps $10 billion for our unfunded liability for PERS and TERS soon. This is a concern for us. We also have deferred maintenance. This year's budget says we have $950 million, almost $1 billion, in deferred maintenance. University of Alaska is asking for $65 or $67 million a year for the next several years to address deferred maintenance. So again, the question is, how are we going to handle it? So what this bill does, it asks the governor to tell us several things. First, we'd like to know what the projected revenues are for the next 25 years. And we want to know by source. Is it oil, gas, forestry, timber? How are we going to make, what are the revenues we're getting for it by source? And of course, the other half of the pie is expenditures. What are those expenditures for the next 25 years? Again, Senator Green's group looked at Medicaid. That's just one little element. There are not a lot of elements that consume much of the budget, but there are a couple that consume a whole lot of the budget that can be looked at. How are we going to balance the budget? We're asking the Constitution to have a balanced budget. What happens when the expenditures are projected to exceed revenues? What's the administration's plan for the future? Are we going to count on the gas pipeline? Well, we don't know right now when that's going to happen. We know it's at least 10 years away, and that gully chart is saying we got a problem now. What we're asking her to tell us, what are the significant changes from last year, and what do you intend to do about those significant changes? If you were counting on a gas pipeline or a PPT or whatever, as we were doing last year, what happens if we don't get it and it's forestalled a year? I just read this week that Venezuela and Brazil are now planning a 7,700-mile natural gas pipeline across South America, more than twice the size of the pipeline that we were talking about building. If there is a shortage for steel and welders for our pipeline, imagine if they begin building their pipeline, where are we going to get our people, and what will it mean for us for building our pipeline? I'm asking her to do a debt analysis. Part of our concern is that our debt can continue to grow, and it's serviced out of our general funds. So what is a proper level of debt, and what is her plan for managing that debt? What's the strategy for unfunded liabilities? How much per year? Are we going to do several $100 million contribution every year? Don't know. What are the necessary actions that the legislature needs to take, and by when, to make her plan work? And of course, the last aspect of the bill is we set an effective date of July 1st so that the information will first be required next January. It will take at least that long, and perhaps longer, I'll have to be honest, to get the information that I'm looking for in this bill. And a final thought, we know you face unprecedented fiscal pressures, as legislatures do everywhere, but it's time to rethink. The time for action is now. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Mr. Schultz, for that testimony. Questions? Senator Bundy.
Just a suggestion. The Department of Labor has an interesting chart about our demographics projected out for the next 25 years, and it shows that the smallest cohort of our population will be the 30 to 50-year-old working group, and the largest cohort will be, I believe, under 5 and over 65. Yes. I'd encourage you to incorporate that chart if you can find it in your comments. It certainly indicates one of the other salient factors in our need to plan ahead.
Yes, sir.
Further questions? Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This is one of those, you know, great ideas that deserves some thought. And I guess one of the ideas that comes to mind is, how does a governor really in any realistic way project beyond the end of his or her own administration? I mean, and how do you get a report that's sort of worth the paper it's printed on when the political landscape changes every 4 years? How can a governor really tell us what, expenditures may be one, income may be one thing where you can sort of look ahead and figure out what the, oil production streams are, what's going to be coming in, but especially expenditures that are so politically driven. How do we get good information about what government expenditures are going to be in 10 years and hope to rely on them?
Through the chair, Senator French, I think it's a good question, one I've wrestled with. Obviously, we don't know with the certainty what our costs are going to be in 25 years or what our revenue will be in 25 years. But we wrestle continuously with what's our oil revenue going to be next year and what's our oil production going to be next year. What I hope to do with this bill is institutionalize as part of this presentation to the legislature every January. If a governor for 4 years says this is what we're going to do, and a new governor comes in and says, time out, I'm changing everything, and presents that to the legislature, part of this bill says you're going to tell us the assumptions that you're basing these projections on. Then you as a legislature have to say, I agree with your assumptions, or no, I don't agree with your assumptions, and challenge them on the budget and where you're going to go. But it's one of these issues that we cannot just say, we'll look at next year and hope for the best after that. Right now, all we're required to do is the governor's to give us an operating budget for 1 year look ahead. And when we're looking at things like a gas pipeline and PPT that impacts a state for 20, 30, or 50 years into the future, we need to have the full picture, or you, the legislatures, need to have a full picture to make informed decisions on what your cost and revenues are expected to be for that 20, 30, or 50 years into the future. And if the new incoming administration says, no, I'm changing things, and they brief you in January as this bill requires, then at that point it's time for you to say, don't agree with the assumptions.
Senator Dyson.
Excellent question. I don't see economics as a dismal science. I find it fascinating. And those folks who labor in that field have evolved some pretty good tools for analyzing. We heard testimony last spring that revenue has always overestimated production and underestimated oil prices, and they have been very consistent with that. With a look back, we can see the patterns. I think that we all, this year, will be asking this governor, is the budget you put on the table sustainable at the production rates your people are predicting and the oil prices? And I suspect the answer will be that this is a transition budget and probably is not sustainable. So then it's our job to say, if it's not, what are you going to do? And Senator Wilkin last spring was talking about a bridge to the future. You know, short-term things we do to get to when the next sugar daddy is going to show up and rescue us. Our press secretary just asked me for a press release on this bill. And I jotted out one, and I said, this bill should help get away from the strategies we've seen in the past, which I call hope or hide. The hope strategy is that a fairy godmother jumps out of the closet with a sparkly stick and new commodities prices or some other unforeseen miracle will rescue us from our financial irresponsibility. And that's the hope one. And all of us, and particularly the youth sitting here at the table, are getting more and more cynical about miraculous deliverances from our own irresponsibilities. The other thing that we have seen in the past is what I call the hide one. You hide the impending problems. You go ahead and spend the money now that's politically popular and hope and hide the impending problems that we are actually exacerbating, and let the next group of policymakers and next administration have to face the stinky stuff in the closet. And so getting this stuff out in the daylight should help to make it so none of the problems are hidden, and every one of us, including the governor's office, will have to answer the question. Fine idea, wonderful thing to spend money on, who's going to pay for it and how? And make us all face those decisions and not rely on near miraculous fairy godmothers or hiding it so that the next gang or our grandchildren have to deal with it.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Well, I think this is will be enormously valuable to have this information and know where the state is going in many ways. But of course, it also seems very costly. So somehow there seems to be a little misalliance here, a dichotomy where we say we're going to figure out, Lucky, in 25 years where the state is going to be, but we can't figure out how much it's going to cost to do this next year. Are you going to sharpen your pencil up and give us some realistic figures?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stevens, I'm not going to come up with the figures, but I know the departments are looking at it in their fiscal notes. A couple of them, if you talk to them, and I'm not going to deal with our economists here because I'm not going to trade numbers with them, but some of them will say that this is a matter of course for a lot of them. Some of the fiscal notes will say not a big deal. I do believe that this will take at least another full-time position year-round. Senator Green probably has a better feel for what the cost just to do the Medicaid study was, since she authorized that last year. But that is something that needs to be considered, a cost-benefit analysis. But again, you're making decisions for a pipeline into several years in the future at billions and billions of dollars. I think you need good information to make that decision.
Okay, and Senator Bundy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Continuing my role as the cynic of the Senate, I am a little, I think, in concurrence with Senator French in that this could be another exercise in smoke and mirrors and feel good and et cetera, et cetera. I suppose it would be then our responsibility to say, well, wait a minute, this is not logical, this does not make sense. And while there's some value, I think, in us receiving, on this side of the table, receiving that information, I think there's far greater value in the people on the other side of that camera receiving the information. You know, Alaskans are very independent, have an incredible variety of points of view on lots of things. The one thing that at least I've heard consistently is there's too much state spending, followed by often there's too much government. Falls apart in the details about what is too much or where we spend too much. But those people on the other side of the camera have to be part of the solution, because right now, I agree, there's often too much spending, but it's because the public has asked for it. The public demands it. The public elects people that says, elect me and I'll bring home the pork. Elect me and I'll protect your dividend or whatever. I mean, people are pandering to folks, politicians are pandering to folks' self-interest, and the folks on the other side have to say, well, there are long-term consequences, or have to understand, I think, there are long-term consequences to what they want, and they still might want those short-term. It's been an Alaskan tradition since the Gold Rush days. Come here, make your stake, and get out. And I think that mentality, to some extent, still exists. I guess I would be happy if this worked and the voting public would at least be aware of potential consequences of whatever their decisions are.
Okay, and I've got one person to testify, and that is Jack Kreinheder. Good. Got it, Jack. And he's here from OMB to offer testimony. Thank you so much, Senator Dyson and Lucky.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll try to keep my remarks brief here. First of all, the Palin administration does fully support the concept of long-term fiscal planning and looking ahead more than just this year and next on the state's finances. And that also ties in with Governor Palin's fiscal year 2008 budget proposal, where some key elements in the governor's budget philosophy are to spend less and control government growth, not only in 08 but through the long term, to save our surpluses, both the FY07 surplus as well as any future surpluses, so that those surplus revenues will be available in the future when oil prices might be lower or production is lower, and to live within our means to keep the FY08 budget to the revenues that are projected to be received in that year. So those are three key elements of a long-term fiscal plan that will help ensure that the state is able to balance its budgets in future years as well as in 2008. Turning to the bill, to SB 25, again, we do support the concept. Some of our concerns echo those that have been stated by members of the panel, Senator French, Senator Bundy, as far as that a document like this needs to be worth the paper it's printed on, and not just kind of an exercise producing an annual report that's going to sit on the shelf and collect dust. We have had some experience with that at Office of Management and Budget over the years, and some long-term. We've been involved in these long-term fiscal planning exercises, I suppose, since the mid-80s when oil prices first took a sharp downturn. So it's valuable work. It needs to be done. The question is, again, just the pros and cons and expenses of doing an annual report that would take quite a bit of staff time to prepare. And is that the most effective use of staff time in supporting the governor's needs and the legislature's needs? The one thing I wanted to comment on was that Senator Dyson and Mr. Schultz showed one of our OMB charts that was prepared last year, called the Gully Chart, showing a projection of long-range spending and revenues through 2020, and thank you for doing that. It highlights the fact that the essence of the state's long-range finances can really be captured in a single chart like that. Not that that chart constitutes a long-range financial plan, but it makes the point that perhaps we don't need a 200 or 300-page annual report to the legislature that most of you folks probably don't have time to read, and that more concise, targeted information may be a better use of your time as well as ours. The from a practical standpoint, a couple of particular concerns. One is the 25-year time horizon, and Mr. Schultz noted, made reference to some other private sector or government plans of 80 to 100 years. So I suppose I'd like to thank the sponsor for not asking for a 100-year plan. Thank you, sir. I guess my great-great-grandchild might be working on that one. Mm-hmm. Looking into the future is always a risky business. We know that, certainly in the revenue forecast, where the one guarantee looking out 15 or 20 years is that you'll be wrong, no matter who's doing the forecast, one way or the other. Looking back at the Gully chart that OMB had prepared last year, that went through 2020, which we're in 2007 now. So that's looking out 13 years. To us, that's a more reasonable time frame. The added value of going from, say, 13 years out to 25 years out, almost doubling the time frame, that added value may be somewhat limited. In other words, how will today's actions by the administration and legislature be affected by something happening, say, 20 to 25 years in the future, that far out?
Do you have a suggested number that you feel or the administration feels more comfortable with?
Well, Madam Chair, I think 13 years is sort of an odd number, so maybe something in the 15-year time frame.
Okay.
And frankly, having done some of these projections over the years, I've been at OMB since 1985, once you get beyond 10 to 15 years, you know, our crystal balls aren't any better than yours, so frequently it ends up being a straight line projection. And you could say, well, how much time does it take you to do that? Not very long. And on the other hand, what's the value? So, and it does add to the paper and bulk of the report and so on. One other thing on the fiscal note, we do appreciate the sponsor and his staff's comment or recognition that this is not a trivial amount of work and would require likely require some additional staff. The fiscal note that I prepared, which you I hope you all have copies of. I did an indeterminate note because in the 5 days that we've known the hearing was happening, we just haven't had sufficient time to to really map out the additional staff required, and it is a little tough to project. So that's why the indeterminate note. If the bill does move along to finance, we probably would put in a request for a specific dollar amount, and more than likely it would be at least one position for OMB. One of the difficulties is looking at other departments that they're likely to be affected as well, because they've got some big pieces of this in terms of Medicaid projections for HESS, for example, enrollment and Education Foundation formula projections for Department of Education and so on. There's another section in here dealing with public facilities that affects at least half a dozen state departments that that manage our facilities and so on. And I'm not really in a position to speak for them, but I have heard some concerns about the work that would be required. So in closing, again, our primary concern is making the most effective use both of our time and yours, again, realizing that 300-page reports frequently don't get read. You know, certainly we could do something smaller, executive summary and so on, but the primary concern is targeting the information, our staff's time, your time to really get at the crux of the matter, and that an annual report tends more often than not to just be put on the shelf. Oh, and just one item I forgot to mention at the outset in terms of fiscal planning, the gully chart also pointed that out, was the challenge we face over the next 10, 12, 15 years until a gas line is likely to be constructed and producing revenue for the state. Two key points there is, one, the governor's commitment and strong emphasis to move that gas line forward and to get those revenues and jobs flowing to the state as quickly as possible. And second, that even though it's a new administration, that gully chart is still accurate. Certainly we can update it for the current revenue forecast and so on in a couple of months. But we need to bridge that gap with declining oil production until a gas line can be in operation. And that's where some of the actions that the legislature can take this session are so important in terms of keeping a lid on spending, not spending our whole surplus so that can be available, and doing everything we can to extend the life of the constitutional budget reserve so that as oil production does drop off, those funds would be available to help balance the budget. And that concludes my remarks. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Senator Bundy.
Just to, you've encouraged me to reiterate a concern that I have, the unsustainable amount of state spending out in the future, it looks like in 2-3 years we'll be in a deficit mode again. And obviously have to start living off our savings in the constitutional budget reserve. My view of this, which is, I think Senator Dyson called it a transition budget, but even as presented, which I don't think anybody in the legislature believes it will be that small. The capital budget is certainly going to be larger than what the governor has projected. Most people think that the $150 million, $60 million in savings will be very difficult to achieve. Even if we achieve that, this year's projected budget goes up $600 million over last year. I mean, it's a tail begins to wag the dog here sometimes. It seems if that's the case. And also, I reiterate my concern that if the Scully, which I believe is true, and we will end up in a deficit and have to live off a constitutional budget reserve savings, the wisdom of putting money in the corpus of the permanent fund where it'd be unavailable to help bridge this gap has to come into question. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Dyson, you heard the 15-year figure. First of all, I would just, you know, this is appropriate to have in state affairs as an initial bill, but I think it's more appropriate to be considered in the Finance Committee. So I would like to be able to move this on to the Finance Committee for it to incorporate in its work and do with it what it will. But there was a suggestion of 15 years, and I wondered what your action was to that.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the remarks. And of course, the value and the credibility, you know, decreases probably geometrically, not exponentially in the out years, but still valuable. And once all this stuff is done the first time, you know, each year the work will be diminished because it'll be just incrementally doing it. We're not wedded to 25 years or 40. I would think of 15 as an absolute as a minimum, and so on. And I appreciate your wanting to move it on. One of the really irritating things that Senator Green has often done with me that has been very valuable, she keeps asking the question, why would you do that? And that's always stiffens me up and makes me think. And this kind of information is going to make all of us ask the question, why would we do that? Why would we be building a state organization and expectations that are not sustainable? And I agree with Senator Bundy, not only are our experts, and we have really good information available and expertise in ledge finance, you know, that'll challenge all of our assumptions and our actions, but I think it's going to be very, very valuable to have that kind of supervision and second-guessing of all of us, and people are going to keep saying, as Senator Green often says to me, why would you do that? And so, anyways, sorry I answered your question. Appreciate your actions.
Okay, anybody else here in the audience that wishes to testify on Senate Bill number 25? Anybody online that I've overlooked? Okay, so public testimony is closed on Senate Bill 25. It brings the bill back before us. Are there amendments from the committee members? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and move that wherever the number 25 is, that it be stricken and replaced with the number 15. And maybe we can get to a point someday of 25, but I think as a starting point, I'd like to propose that and respect OMB's opinion that it starts kind of wavering beyond that. And so I think the information needs to be valuable. So that's amendment number one. Is there a discussion or objection? Okay, Senator Green.
There's on page four. I wonder if that the six-year increment there, does that is that impacted by the change to 15?
No.
Okay.
That's already.
But you also have an additional 6 years. Page four, line four.
And number seven, I see what you're saying.
And I thought maybe there were multiple 6 year, and I didn't want it to go past the 15, that's all.
Which one?
Line four. And then it's mentioned again on line seven.
To the chair, Senator Green. No,
those just. One's operating and one's capital.
This just asks for the six-year number that is already in okay. The statute to say where what the sources are for the 6 years.
Okay.
Right.
Thank
now
you.
It just says 1 year operating budget, 6 year capital improvements budget. This just says where the, what are the sources for those 6 years.
Thank you.
Okay. Further discussion or objection to the amendment? Okay. Hearing none, amendment number one carries. Further amendments to Senate Bill number 25. Further discussion? Can I get a motion, Senator Bundy?
Yes, I would move that we move from committee Senate Bill 25 with individual recommendations as amended.
Okay, any objection? Hearing none, Senate Bill number 25 moves. We're at 10:30, so we'll go ahead and adjourn the committee today and come back to business on Tuesday.
Thanks.
Okay?